different lengths called the Paleogene and Neogene. Others divide the Precambrian into two eras, the very ancient Archean and the more recent Proterozoic. Sometimes, too, you will see the term Phanerozoic used to describe the span encompassing the Cenozoic, Mesozoic, and Paleozoic eras. Moreover, all this applies only to units of time. Rocks are divided into quite separate units known as systems, series, and stages. A distinction is also made between late and early, referring to time, and upper and lower, referring to layers of rock. It can all get terribly confusing to non-specialists, but to a geologist, these can be matters of passion. I have seen grown men glow incandescent with rage over this metaphorical millisecond in life's history. The British paleontologist Richard Forte has written, with regard to a long-running 20th century dispute over where the boundary lies between the Cambrian and the Ordovician. At least today, we can bring some sophisticated dating techniques to the table. For most of the 19th century, geologists could draw on nothing more than the most hopeful guesswork. The frustrating position then was that although they could place the various rocks and fossils in order by age, they had no idea how long any of those ages were. When Buckland speculated on the antiquity of Nycthiosaurus' skeleton, he could do no better than suggest that it had lived somewhere between 10,000 or more than 10,000 times 10,000 years earlier. Although there was no reliable way of dating periods, there was no shortage of people willing to try. The most well-known early attempt was in 1650, when Archbishop James Usher of the Church of Ireland made a careful study of the Bible and other historical sources and concluded in a hefty tome called Annals of the Old Testament that the earth had been created at midday on October the 23rd, 4004 BC, an assertion that has amused historians and textbook writers ever since. Although virtually all books find a space for him, there is a striking variability in the details associated with Usher. Some books say he made his pronouncement in 1650, others in 1654, still others in 1664. Many cite the date of Earth's reputed beginning as October 26th. The matter is interestingly surveyed in Stephen Jay Gould's Eight Little Piggies. There is a persistent myth, incidentally, and one propounded in many serious books, that Usher's views dominated scientific beliefs well into the 19th century, and that it was Lyell who put everyone straight. Stephen Jay Gould in Time's Arrow cites as a typical example this sentence from a popular book of the 1980s. Until Lyell published his book, most thinking people accepted the idea that the Earth was young. In fact, no. As Martin J.S. Rudwick puts it, no geologist of any nationality whose work was taken seriously by other geologists advocated a timescale confined within the limits of a literalistic exegesis of Genesis. Even the Reverend Buckland, as pious a soul as the 19th century produced, noted that nowhere did the Bible suggest that God made heaven and earth on the first day, but merely in the beginning. That beginning, he reasoned, may have lasted millions upon millions of years. Everyone agreed that the earth was ancient. The question was simply, how ancient? One of the better early attempts at dating the planet came from the ever-reliable Edmund Halley, who in 1715 suggested that if you divided the total amount of salt in the world's seas by the amount added each year, you would get the number of years that the oceans had been in existence, which would give you a rough idea of Earth's age. The logic was appealing, but unfortunately no one knew how much salt was in the sea or by how much it increased every year, which rendered the experiment impracticable. The first attempt at measurement that could be called remotely scientific was made by the Frenchman Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, in the 1770s. It had long been known that the Earth radiated appreciable amounts of heat. That was apparent to anyone who went down a coal mine. But there wasn't any way of estimating the rate of dissipation. Buffon's experiment consisted of heating spheres until they glowed white hot, and then estimating the rate of heat loss by touching them, presumably very lightly at first, as they cooled. From this, he guessed the Earth's age to be somewhere between 75,000 and 168,000 years old. This was, of course, a wild underestimate, but a radical notion nonetheless, and Buffon found himself threatened with excommunication for expressing it. A practical man, he apologized at once for his thoughtless heresy, then cheerfully repeated the assertions throughout his subsequent writings. By the middle of the 19th century, most learned people thought the Earth was at least a few million years old, perhaps even some tens of millions of years old, but probably not more than that. So it came as a surprise when, in 1859, in On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin announced that the geological processes that created the Weald, an area of southern England stretching across Kent, Surrey and Sussex, had taken, by his calculations, 306,662,400 years to complete. The assertion was remarkable, partly for being so arrestingly specific, but even more for flying in the face of accepted wisdom about the age of the Earth. Darwin loved an exact number. In a later work, he announced that the number of worms to be found in an average acre of English country soil was 53,767. It proved so contentious that Darwin withdrew it from the third edition of the book. The problem at its heart remained, however. Darwin and his geological friends needed the Earth to be old, but no one could figure out a way to make it so. Unfortunately for Darwin, and for progress, the question came to the attention of the great Lord Kelvin, who, though indubitably great, was then still just plain William Thompson. He wouldn't be elevated to the peerage until 1892, when he was 68 years old and nearing the end of his career, but I shall follow the convention here of using the name retroactively. Kelvin was one of the most extraordinary figures of the 19th century, indeed of any century. The German scientist Hermann von Helmholtz, no intellectual slouch himself, wrote that Kelvin had by far the greatest intelligence and lucidity and mobility of thought of any man he had ever met. I felt quite wooden beside him sometimes, he added a bit dejectedly. The sentiment is understandable, for Kelvin really was.